It is Wednesday morning. It is June 12th, and we have some baseball to talk about. And good news, everybody, Jake Mintz's voice is at least kind of back.
It is back enough. And that, like a home run, is all that matters. On this episode, we'll be talking about the underwhelming Atlanta Braves, the overwhelming Paul Skeens, and the one, the only, Reintaro Sasaki. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world willing to replace Joey Chestnut at the Wiener Eating Jamboree. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. How many hot dogs do you think the two of us could eat combined in 12 minutes?
In that, like, under the bright lights, you know, of Coney Island, man, I don't know, probably in 10, 12 minutes. 15? Nah, probably not even that many. I doubt that.
I think I'm good for at least 10.
Okay.
Because I am a disgusting slob.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I do love a hot dog.
I do like hot dogs. Yeah. It's not an issue with that.
I think our performance would play up if we got to do it inside the baseball stadium right down the street from where they do the national hot dog eating contest. But it is a baseball podcast. It is not a glizzy oriented program. So we will begin with the baseball. Jordan Schusterman, first off, how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm doing all right. I know you are heading off to Omaha, Nebraska later today. I'm mildly jealous, but I still have a lot of settling in to do to my new home and plenty of other Major League Baseball to worry about. But I'm excited to see you next week. We have a big week next week, Jake. We haven't even really talked about it publicly, but I'll just say it here now. We're going to the MLB Draft Combine for the first time. And we are very excited about that. So all kinds of content coming your way next week. But got to get through this first weekend of Omaha. Got to get through these next couple of days of Major League Baseball. And so I'm excited for that. But this will be a little bit more of a standard show.
And on this standard show, we will begin with an unstandard topic. And that is the Atlanta Braves being bad. In their last 40 games, the Bravos are 17-23, coming off a season in which I believe they led MLB in wins and had the best offense arguably in baseball history.
It was up there, yeah.
The Braves assembled, it's the same core, it's the same group, it's eight of the same nine hitters, have been downright blah for the last 6 weeks, 7 weeks.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They are still firmly in possession of a postseason spot because the National League stinks. They are, as of this morning, 35-29. That is 4 games up on the second wild card spot and 5.5 up on the third wild card spot. But the big number to know is that the Atlanta Braves are 10 games back of the Philadelphia Phillies in the division. And things arguably reached a new low last night. They were shut out by the Baltimore Orioles. Not the most embarrassing thing. However, they were shut out by the Baltimore Orioles by a gentleman named Albert Suarez, who is a 36-year-old journeyman spot starter. He's been good, but still a 36-year-old journeyman spot starter. It is the second time they've been shut out in the last week. They had been shut out just once in the previous year before this week, which is absolutely nuts. And to make things even more bizarre, Jordan, last night they were shut out after starting the game with a Michael Harris leadoff triple. Braves beat writer Mark Bowman in his write-up of last night's game mentioned it's the first time that's happened since 2021. And the idea of getting shut out, like you hit a leadoff triple, guy's right there. And then you just don't get close again. So that's the deal with the Braves. We're going to dig in a little bit why we think this team has underwhelmed.
Yeah, and I think, you'll lay it out. This is, of course, a team you're rather familiar with. But you mentioned that triple, and there were a couple other moments last night where it was somewhat indicative of at least some of the unfortunate luck that this team has been having, because you mentioned that Michael Harris triple, a little bit later. I guess Michael Harris triple is one thing. Maybe that's not a home run, but Sean Murphy in the second inning hits a fly ball that would have been a home run in literally every other ballpark except for in Baltimore. And that's the situation which you reminded me when I tweeted some of the numbers about how bad the Braves offense has been. Some people responding, oh, but they're you know, top five in hard hit rate and exit velocity and you know, all these barrel rate, whatever. And like, yeah, that's true. And that's fair. And you could say, okay, well, they're hitting the ball pretty hard. It can't be this bad. However, the numbers have been bad enough to where you cannot just say, oh no, they're just getting unlucky. It is way, way, way beyond that. Sure, maybe they are getting unlucky. That's making it look worse than it is, but that doesn't mean it's not bad, because this is a collective failing so far of this offense at a time when their pitching, as we've mentioned, has actually generally shown up. But besides Ozuna, man, they've just really haven't been able to count on many of these guys recently.
And what's so bizarre is, I mean, last year's team and the teams over the last couple seasons, right, it's felt like the Braves are only beginning this wave of contention in some ways. They're all locked up forever. Most of them are fairly young. And so it felt very sustainable, and it still feels very sustainable. I want to be clear, like a 6-week frigid stretch, in my mind, I don't think it completely changes or meaningfully changes how I feel about the Braves over the next 5 seasons. I would say Acuña's injury does slightly more than anything else, just because I have doubts about how athletic he's going to be with major surgery on both legs. I think that's legit. But this stretch over the last 6 weeks has just been so bad. It's been so cold. It's been so blatant. And I have maintained faith in this team and their quality at the plate winning out. And I think that there are a number of hitters here who will come back around and start to show some more production. But like you said, you can't just wave away this lack of productivity because of bad luck. It's definitely more than that.
I also think that the other dynamic here, which you sort of alluded to, is that like, this is the team. Like, it's not even just that there's not a ton coming on the farm, certainly on a position player side where it's about as thin as it is for any farm system across the league. But this is part of it. And we joked about it, and it was hard to say it was a bad thing, where it's just like, let's get all these players that are either under team control for a while or under these extensions. And it's like, this is it. These are our guys. And you couldn't see. And now Alex Anthopoulos can sit back and chill until he has to make a trade. Now, clearly, he was active on the pitching side this past offseason. And it's a good thing he was, because you can imagine how dire things would be were he not as aggressive when it comes to improving the pitching staff. But the offensive group, it was just like, yeah, like, what are you going to tell them to do? Like, why would I tell them to change anything? Like, this is the group that they're rolling with, but now it's also the group that they're stuck with, because not only is there nothing below them, it doesn't really make any sense to punt on any of these guys. And that's what's really difficult.
But I want to push back a little bit. Like, I don't think stuck is a fair way to describe it. I think they're locked in. I don't think it's a problem. Now, it could be a problem if these guys start to underwhelm.
Sure.
I just want to compare this to when I was in Pittsburgh for Paul Skeens' debut, and their president of baseball operations, Ben Charrington, communicated to the media. He said something along the lines of, this position player group is our position player group. The people who are going to help us win are already here. And when you looked at the roster and you heard that, you kind of went, yay.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeesh. Yeesh. Mm-hmm. This is not a particularly enthralling group. Whereas for the Braves, I think the quality will win out. I just want to, let's dig into some of the specifics. So the first thing that's obvious here is injury. And the injury specifically, I mean, Acuña is the big one, right? Yes, he was underwhelming until he tore his ACL. He was average. He wasn't God level like he was a year ago. But still, he was a productive player, a real contributor, who felt like he was just an inch away from making it happen, from showing the Ronald Acuña-ness that he showed all of last year. And with him out for the rest of the season, he won't have the chance to do that. I don't need to explain that to you, the intelligent listener, why missing Ronald Acuña for 4 months is bad for your baseball team, right? That's like saying eating dirt is bad for your health. You know, that should be
intuitive. Thanks for clarifying. Yes, it's good to know.
Yeah.
Jake
knows ball. However, there are two other, maybe three, other injury-ish situations here that are worth noting. The big one is Sean Murphy, who got hurt on opening day with an oblique situation, right? He was one of the best catchers in the league last year. he was one of the best players in baseball for the first couple months of last season after being acquired from the Oakland A's, slid a little bit down the stretch. Since getting back from the IL a couple of weeks ago, he has been abysmal. He's been terrible, just flat out awful. And it's difficult for me to, like, when you watch him, he just doesn't look as explosive and as dynamic as he did at the beginning of last season, even at the end of last season. And it's hard for me to know that he has an oblique issue or had an oblique issue and looks this lost. It's difficult not to connect those two things.
Sure. I will say about Murphy, though, and again, I have no idea if there were injuries at play, or maybe I should say I don't remember if there are injuries at play. I think to say he slid down the stretch is a pretty heavy understatement. This is a guy who had a 999 OPS in the first half last year. To your point, one of the best players in baseball. I mean, that as a catcher is unbelievable. 585 OPS after the break. So it wasn't just like, oh, he's a league average hitter now instead of one of the best hitters. He was atrocious down the stretch too. I don't know if that was injury related or not, but it did. It was a brutal September, and kind of for that to carry into this season when you thought you had one of the best catchers in baseball is troubling. Now you have Travis d'Arnaud, right? Like, that's another example of the Braves' depth kind of saving their ass, because that's another thing where Travis d'Arnaud's still chilling here at age 35 with the 760 OPS, credit to him. But that is an elite spot on your team that is not that right now.
Yeah. And then the other one is Austin Riley.
Yeah, this is the one that I am like the most, and I again could dig into it more, and maybe you have some specific, you know, underlying stuff. But when we just think about the trajectory of Austin Riley, this is a guy who the last 3 years has finished 7th, 6th, 7th in NL MVP voting and has missed like 4 games, right? This is about as bankable of a second tier superstar as we had in this sport. And the comparison I would make is that I like to think about him and Kyle Tucker in a very similar way, where it's like, these dudes are boring as hell, but boy, are they good at baseball. And boy, is it incredibly important to have them on your team and to just be able to pencil in exactly what you know what you're getting for 155 plus games. And this year, Kyle Tucker somehow took an even bigger leap. And Austin Riley has gone just, again, like, to have this sample of success over 3 full seasons without missing any time and then suddenly have a 635 OPS, it's hard for me not to look at this and be like, is he injured? And I don't know if there's anything involving that, but man, and sure, there's been some bad luck here and there, but, you know, sure, you say, okay, yeah, the BABIP's 294, so you can't even really look at that. So, and the strikeouts aren't even that up, right? This isn't a situation where his approach is totally gone. The walk rate and the strikeout rate are about the same. The hard hit rate is down a little bit. It's just not working out, and it's very weird.
You could argue that his approach, his swing decision-making is better this year. I mean, he's chasing less. He's swinging more in the strike zone, at pitches in the strike zone, which is what you want to do. Yeah. He missed a stretch in May with inflammation in his intercostal muscles, which is, you know, the space between your ribs. It was on his left side, right? Now, there's been some discussion about obliques and ribs and sides for hitters being the elbow ligament for pitchers.
The ultimate.
Just because of how you rotate. I mean, obliques are so vital. And I'm confused because his exit velocity stuff isn't down. That's what you would expect.
It's down a tiny, right?
It's down
tiny
a little bit.
Yeah, but it's
down
not,
a little bit. But you would
still
expect
well above
if
league
he was,
average. Yeah,
right. He's still rotating with some real zip. Now, maybe there are some under the hood things that the Braves have that reflect he's you know, not doing that. But as far as what we can see, however, go look at his numbers against heaters. Okay, he's hitting 111. Batting average 111 with a 181 slug against four-seam fastballs, right?
That's not going to cut it.
That's the problem. Now, that could be because maybe he's not moving as quick, his muscles aren't firing as early, and he's not able to catch up to those pitches, right? Yeah. Now, same thing with Murphy. Guy misses extended time because of an issue with his side, and then his numbers are bad when he gets back. It's like, okay, well, maybe he's behind, maybe he's unlucky, but it's hard to not draw that connection there. Riley is young enough, smart enough, and athletic enough that I'm going to bet on him bouncing back at some point. He has not allowed a lack of batted ball production to impact his swing decision-making. and I think deserves some credit for that. He stayed the course.
Yep.
And I think that over time, it will come around for him as he gets healthier and healthier. Yeah. He's just not getting the ball in the air at the optimal launch angles to the same extent.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's the Austin Riley thing. And then the one other, I guess, thing you could squint at would be Ozzie Albies, who he hit 33 homers last year, which is kind of wild. He's only on pace for 12 as of right now. Now, his barrel rate has been cut in half. He's not elevating the baseball the way he should be. He had an IL stint in April for fracturing a toe, which feels like this type of thing that should keep you out for longer than like 10 days.
Right.
I mean, I'm not a doctor, but
that's a weird one. But again, you mentioned he's only on pace. I mean, this is a thing across, right? The power outage kind of across the board is staggering. This team had 307 home runs last year. And sure, you know, 40 of them are Acuna, but second was 249, right? Like they were lapping if you took out Acuna's 40 home runs last year, they still would have been in first place. I mean,
they tied the MLB record for most homers in a season.
Right. Right.
Tying the Twins from the Juice Ball Hero Twins. Yeah. Right. And so I would say era adjusted, this is the most homers a team's ever hit. They're the only team ever to have a slugging percentage over 500. Mm-hmm. Right. This was the best offense ever. And so for it to drop off this totally comes from a bunch of different places. Now there are a couple players who I think I'm more confident are going to kind of rebound, and that's Michael Harris and Matt Olson. So Olson, again, he hit 54 homers last year. And unless you're Aaron Judge, you don't do that again. That's just, he was like playing above his skis last year. He's a very talented player. 54 home runs is beyond anybody's normal capabilities.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it was no duh that he was going to come back down. Mm-hmm. He slugged 633 against fastballs last year.
Yeah.
633.
Yeah. Right? I think he's not doing that this year.
No, nobody does that over a long stretch of time. That being said, he's been fine. He hasn't been bad.
He's been better recently.
Yeah. All the batted ball, like he's the one who is suffering from bad luck the most. And I just think Matt Olson will finish the year with 35 home runs. Like that, I'm fine.
All right. That's interesting because he's on pace right now for like 25. And again, that's the thing. You look across the board, you say, the peripherals are a little bit worse. Harris, I'm interested that you say you're confident in that one because his approach is kind of the most volatile. But the talent, of course,
it's the same as it was last year.
Yeah,
it's basically the same as it was last year. Michael Harris, at least this current version of Michael Harris, is going to strike out a ton, right? He was chasing, swinging at pitches outside the zone at a 38% clip last year, which is super high, and was still a really productive player, right? This year, that number is up to 43%, which is like borderline unsustainable in terms of chasing. I think it's like second worst percentile in baseball.
Yeah.
But when you swing that much, like you're going to go through some cold stretches.
Right.
I think that he is, like Riley, talented, athletic enough. Like he was so good last year that I think his true talent is above what he's been doing this year. And if you look at the gap between batted ball data and batted ball outcomes, he's probably one of the guys who's been the most unfortunate.
Yeah, that's true. I would say, you know, with Harris, what's amazing is he's always swung at everything, but he actually hasn't struck out that much because he has this incredible bat to ball skills. Now, at the same time, you chase enough, you're producing a lot of bad contact. And that's clearly his issue right now. But I would say, again, the other thing across the board, you know, we mentioned the home runs with them, which is pretty astonishing. But, you know, last year when they're leading baseball by a laughable margin, right now they have 65 homers, which I believe ranks around middle of the pack, you know, 16th or 17th, not, you know, remotely close to the top of the league. But the other thing that stands out is, and not that this was like a major thing for them outside of Acuna last year, but boy, are they not running. This is a team that currently has 29 stolen bases in, which ranks 28th, and, you know, just almost tied with the Tigers, who are 29th. And that's the thing, you know, maybe I'm overrating steals and how much it really contributes to run production. But again, when you have kind of an offensive identity and things are not working out on the power side, how do you end up with, you know, the lowest runs per game over the last 6 weeks in the entire league? Well, you're not getting a lot of extra bases. You're not in scoring position because you're not slugging as much as you used to be. And, you're just not a lot of guys in the position to be scoring. And clearly they haven't been, they don't really have the personnel right now to be taking advantage of that. And that's another thing that I would say is somewhat limiting of their team. And I would say Texas is a team that's very similar in that regard, where they don't have that speed element right now. So they really rely on the power. And we saw earlier in the season when that wasn't coming, they're losing a lot of games, slowly coming out of it. But that is one issue with some of the problem is a bit of a stretch because the talent is so strong, but it is kind of a something that can help sort of prevent sort of the and we know that's another thing with Acuna when we think about the offense last year and how dynamic it was, how much of a difference he makes at the top of the lineup there from both power and speed standpoint. Not having that is tough.
And then the last, you know, three players that are worth mentioning, Orlando Arcia, BFFF. He's been getting relatively lucky this year, which is bizarre because he's like the surface level numbers are bad, but below the hood, it's even worse. And that's the thing with Arcia, right? Last year, he was a totally average offensive player, which was above what his career norms were.
Yeah.
Remember, I mean, this was a guy
who
was
batting 8th and 9th. So, yeah.
Yeah. It was like, great. It was totally fine. If you have average hitter batting 8th or 9th, like, that's a great thing. He was a reserve bench guy for the Braves for a couple of years before they gave him the starting role for a reason, right? He is a limited offensive player. He has a lot of raw juice, right? But he's limited with the bat. Now, his defense is still great, and he is not the problem. The Braves were not banking on a 110 OPS plus from Orlando Arcia in 2024. That's not the point, right? And as long as he continues to play really good defense at an important position, that's not a problem. He, I think, will be, like, he will be better. Like, he's just been so bad that I just think it'll come back up a little bit. And then the other two guys, Ozuna, oh my God. Like,
best
top five hitter in the world.
Him. Holy crap. I mean, this is crazy. This is what he was in 2020. And so now the question is, well, he did it in 60 games in 2020. He's done it in 60 games in 2024. What do the remaining 100 games look like for him? But yeah, I mean, it's hard to argue with what he's done.
And then the one spot that they switched over was Jared Kelenic coming in, Eddie Rosario going out. I mean, that's been fine. Like, Kelenic's been average.
Yeah.
Again, if the other Braves were doing anything remotely close to what they were doing last year, Kelenic wouldn't even be a story. It'd be like, oh, wow, they're getting solid production at the bottom from Jared Kelenic. He is really streaky. It could be a really tough watch when he's not going well.
Yeah. As he's doing his job. He's generally doing his job. But yeah, man, they're just one more thing on the stolen bases. You know, they have 29 steals. 16 of those are Acuna. So, and 8 are Michael Harris. So, like, it's just not part of their game. It is not a factor. It's not something that opposing, you know, pitching staffs have to worry about whatsoever. And that is very different than when you're playing a team with Ronald Acuna.
Just to wrap this conversation up. So, they're 10 games back. Mm-hmm. There's no question that the Phillies have to be considered the favorite in the NL East right now.
I mean, now Fangraphs has them at like 90% to win the division.
Yeah.
I think that's fair.
What are your expectations for the Atlanta Braves? Obviously, they've changed a lot. Losing the best pitcher on the planet and arguably the best position player on the planet in the same two-month span would sink a lot of teams. And there's an excuse there. Like, you don't want to make excuses. That's a legitimate excuse.
Yeah.
Like, in my mind. Yeah. Totally fine. If the Braves underwhelm, maybe I'm being too kind.
Yeah.
The Braves underwhelm. They lost two of the best players in the world to season-ending injuries. Well, wrap it up. We'll do it again next year. Now, I don't think that's the case. This team's going to be in the playoffs. They're not going to fall off that hard. They'll be there. And what's interesting to me is that they're kind of switching roles here with the Phillies.
Yeah.
Right.
100%. Totally switched. Just now. Right. And they're going to go into, because of these injuries, it's like, what is their ultimate ceiling, regardless of who they're going to play in the postseason again? But to your point, right, this is, it's like, all right, well, now Atlanta, you're going to be playing, you know, that first, no rust for you. You don't have to worry about being rusty because you ain't getting a bye. So,
dude, that's the galaxy brain. That's the galaxy brain thought here is the Braves who were complaining about the layoff in between the end of the season and the playoffs. They're purposefully sandbagging,
especially because, you know, by the time they start to heat up down the stretch, you don't want to take that break. Right? You don't want to take that break. You want to roll that right into that wild card game.
Genius.
So, now, right now, that would be against, you know, the Padres. But it's very likely we will be watching Atlanta right in that spot the whole time, the way we watched Philly in that exact spot the whole time, you know, last year. So
12D chess, next level strat.
So we'll see how much. But yeah, they're listen, I am more worried than you. I will officially say that. I not that I think they're going to miss the postseason, but like at this point, man, it wouldn't stun me if they do kind of fall back into that it isn't as comfortable atop this.
Let me ask you this. Mix.
Yeah.
More likely to win the World Series, the Atlanta Braves or the Milwaukee Brewers?
Oh, man, that is a great
question.
Both
will presumably need to play the first round, right? The Phillies and the Dodgers are almost locks in my mind to get the buys.
Yes. Man, I think I still would say Atlanta there. The Milwaukee starting pitching numbers are just shocking. Like, they have the fewest starts of any team in baseball of like six innings, like, or maybe even five innings. Like, it is, I just look at that team and I say, unless they make a serious move for a starter, it's so hard to imagine them getting through the postseason. But, and I like the Brewers. I'm so impressed with what they've done.
That's kind of my point. Here are the teams I definitively feel better about in October than the Atlanta Braves right now, from where we sit. Dodgers, the Phillies, the Yankees, probably the Orioles.
But in the NL, I mean, for
and then who?
Sure.
And then who? Right? That's four teams.
Yeah.
Like, I probably feel better about the Braves even still than Cleveland. Maybe that's disrespectful. Mm-hmm. Right? Maybe that's disrespectful. But, like,
they have pitching
Atlanta starting pitching has been so good. No one in your freaking crapo division in the AL West. That's for freaking sure.
Well, that's, that's true.
I know the Mariners have been better, but, like, still, I just, that's what I kind of want to communicate is everyone sucks.
Sure.
And
and in the NL especially, the Braves have
underwhelmed and they've been disappointing and the offense has been sleepy, but I would still put them as like my fifth likeliest team to win the World Series behind LA, Philly, New York, Baltimore. And like, again, that's not what the expectation is here for this franchise. I understand that, but the bottom has not fallen out so far.
No.
Yet. No. It might. It could. And I have faith. Listen, I just think this team is talented enough. That they're
going to 18-6 start is going to keep them comfortable for a while. So I think they'll be okay. But it doesn't help when you're just getting your ass whooped by other really good teams, right? Like, that always is a tough look. But the Orioles are amazing. So
just quickly on the Orioles, and then we'll take a break. They have a outrageous stretch that they're going through. Do you know about this?
We're going to need a little more details.
I'm just talking about their schedule. Like, they're
okay. Just you know in terms this? Of the no, I guess I don't.
Okay, so there's two things. One is that they have no off days. So they have one off day in June. That in and of itself is exhausting.
Oh, that reminds me of the other thing about the Braves is that they've played the fewest games in baseball. Mm. So that's another thing. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. It means that they will also have very, very few off days in the second half. Maybe that is a good thing. Maybe it's not. They have games that they can still make up, but that's just another thing to mention. But sorry, continue about Baltimore.
Here's Baltimore's June schedule. Ready? 3 against Tampa, 4 against Toronto, 3 against Tampa, 3 against Atlanta, 3 against Philly, off day, 3 against the Yankees, 3 against Houston, 3 against Cleveland, 4 against Texas.
Yeah.
Pretty sick.
Yeah.
Pretty hard stretch there, particularly in the middle of 3 Atlanta, 3 Philly, 3 the Yankees, 3 at the Yankees, 3 at the Astros. That's
true.
Fun.
Yeah, and again, like, it's hard to have a hard stretch when there aren't that many good teams.
But they found one.
So, that will be. But hey, they're very capable of doing this. And watching, you know, Baltimore kick Atlanta's ass, watching the Yankees kick the Royals' ass, these two teams are just kind of separating themselves, and it is very, very, very impressive. I know most fans don't want to hear about that.
So,
all right. Yeah.
I hope, my hope is if they keep doing this, we get a Yankees Orioles ALCS and not an ALDS, just so we can have 7 games worth of it.
Yes. Well said, but that is jumping very, very, very far ahead. All right, Jake, let's take a quick break. And when we return, we're going to talk about Paul Skenes. Ever heard of him? We're going to talk about Rintaro Sasaki. Who's that? If you don't know, you better know. We'll be right back on Baseball Talk.
And welcome back to Baseball Pharmacast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. My voice is hanging in there. I'm day to day on the vocal IL, but I'm playing through the pain because I ain't no sucker. Jordan, speaking of not a sucker, Paul Skenes is very much not a sucker. Holy Lord.
Let me just say, I haven't really had, we've had some amazing pitchers come up recently. A lot of talent. There are pitchers that have been in the league a long time that I like to tune into. I'm not missing Skeen starts right now. I'm not, whatever, like, it's like, oh, that's on the schedule. Let's make sure, like, I'm telling Bailey, like, hey, so Skeens is pitching tonight. So, like, that's part of the schedule today. Keep that in mind. That is where I'm at with the Paul Skeens.
And my fiance, on the other hand, I believe recently pronounced his name as Skenes.
Skenes. I actually had that thought when I first found him when he was a freshman in Air Force. I was like, that is an interesting name.
I would love to throw an NA on it. Paul Skenes. Rhymes with beignets.
Anyway.
There's a lot of incorrect ways to pronounce this name.
Oh, for sure. Paul Skenes.
Skenes.
But now it's like, it's normal because he's one of the best pitchers I've ever seen. Anyway, Paul Skenes made his Busch Stadium debut last night. Let me tell you, Busch Stadium enjoyed it. While Miles Michaelis was throwing a perfect game through five innings on the other side, because as Jake mentioned earlier, that Pirates offense, not exactly the most intimidating. Paul Skenes was basically going, you know, toe-to-toe here. He pitches into the seventh inning, and when they sent him back out, this is, okay, they send Paul Skenes back out at close to 100 pitches in the middle of the order. He gets Goldschmidt at the end of the sixth, and he's nearing 100. And with Gorman coming up, the next three batters being Gorman, Arenado, Donovan, and they show Aroldis Chapman warming, everyone just assumes, all right, you know, Skenes, he threw six great innings. That's fantastic. And then he comes back out. And I got to say, like, it was, the Pirates broadcast is like freaking out. They're like, can you believe this? We're going old school. Here comes Paul Skenes for the seventh inning. I was like, it's sad because, like, it's true. That is where we are at with starting pitching now. But also, man, I watched Paul Skenes throw 120 pitches every week last year for LSU and pitch into the seventh inning like almost every time. Like, I this shouldn't be that big of a deal. However, I understand why it was, and it was cool to see him come out and get Gorman. He strikes out Gorman, and then Arenado kind of bloops him for a hit to knock him out before they take him out of the game. But he was marvelous. I think the thing that stood out. Clearly what happened, what was the headline? He comes off the mound and the Cardinals fans give him a standing ovation. And it was Cardinals fans, right? It's not like, I mean, with all due respect to our new favorite follow, Mr. Sax Boy, who was in attendance.
Legend.
There weren't that many Pirates fans there. And it was a legitimate standing ovation, which in the moment I immediately clocked it. I was like, wow, like there's probably going to be some hardos that get on online, they're like, this is embarrassing. Like, how could you cheer the opposing pitcher? However, I think that there's two factors that allowed this to happen. One, it was the first time Skenes had pitched there, and there was a novelty to it. Two, it was still 0-0. Like, if the Pirates were up by 10, this would have been a little bit more of a tough look. And then three, like, Skenes has kind of transcended to where it's just like, oh man, like, that was so cool.
Yeah, I wanted to put on our first take hats for a second. It is Cardinals fans cheering Paul Skenes to sign. They're going soft.
Right, exactly. That was the first thing I thought. And then I was like, Skenes just is like, at some point they will be booing him a lot. They will be cheering when he gets knocked out after allowing two runs. Like, that will happen multiple times in his career there.
Yeah.
But for now, man, so, it was cool.
Again, St. Louis defender logging on. There are a lot of reasons to dislike Cardinals fans. Trust me. I lived there for 4 years. I know. However, they like ball. Yeah, they really like ball.
Yeah.
And they appreciated this ball.
Yeah,
and
they did.
The one thing you missed, Jordan, is the Cardinals pitching staff recently has been famous for what?
What? Being old?
Not throwing the ball hard. Okay. Oh, and so these Cardinals fans are like used to seeing Adam Wainwright and Miles Michaelis just like
whoa,
thumb 89 over the middle.
In the first inning, right? You have Helsley, right? You have some hard throws in the pen. But to watch a guy do it for multiple innings, my gosh.
Now they're that's crazy.
Yeah, wow, that's allowed. Man, they had Jordan Hicks. They didn't particularly enjoy that. The one thing that stood out about Paul Skenes again, because I'm watching every start so ridiculously closely, most we've seen of his curveball last night. However, the slider was also basically at the same velocity, according to StatCast. So seems like he was just going really hard, breaking ball heavy in that outing. Whether he didn't have quite the feel for one or the other, it was still a nasty pitch. And it was a reminder of kind of all the weapons that he kind of has at his disposal here. Because yes, that 95 mile an hour splitter is ridiculous. And yes, of course, he's got 100. But when those breaking balls are working, he can just carve, and he's just being able to do it in so many different ways. And it's so interesting when he does allow hits, you immediately think like, oh, what was that pitch call? But you can imagine it's like, man, it's, if you're a Grandal calling this game, it's like every pitch seems so good. But then sometimes it's like, why would you throw that when you have that pitch? But that's a good problem to have. And that is where Paul Skenes is at right now. So, man, yeah, it is just a joy to watch him pitch all the time. And I am going to continue enjoying it. I'm already now curious what his next start is going to be, which I'm going to look at quickly. But, yeah, anything else on Skenes?
I just love the idea of a little Cardinals fan child turning to Cardinals fan parent. Mom. Dad, are you allowed to throw that hard? That's crazy.
Whoa, did that say 99? Normally it says 89.
I didn't know that's allowed.
This is strange. Oh, this is interesting. Oh, I guess they go to Colorado. So never mind. They're going to Colorado this weekend. I assume he wouldn't start in Coors on Sunday, but maybe, probably not. Otherwise, they go home next week to face the Reds. So that would be my assumption. I would assume that will be Paul Skenes' next start. Will be at home against the Reds for their first matchup of the year. All right, Jake, let us move on to our final topic. And then we got a bit of breaking news just here, a little bit of a hot stove action here in the middle of June, which we'll get to, involving the team on my hat, which is the Blue Jays, if you're just listening. Yeah. Jake, let's talk about what happened in Frederick, Maryland. Last night. What? Frederick? Who cares about Frederick, Maryland? This is a place we've been. This is a place we have attended ball games before.
Many times.
However, not like this.
No.
Frederick Keys have changed many times.
Go ahead. Let's speed run this backstory.
Why the Frederick Keys had a 18-year-old Japanese player playing there last night.
All right. First, Frederick Keys used to be the high A affiliate for the Baltimore Orioles. When MLB axed all the clubs, the Keys then became part of the MLB Draft League. Okay, who is the MLB Draft League for? The MLB Draft League is for players that are in college and some players that are about to be in college to have a competitive experience over the summer. MLB still runs aspects of the league and helps facilitate it, but the teams themselves are now independent and not affiliated with MLB teams. Another one of the teams in the MLB Draft League is the Trenton Thunder. The Trenton Thunder used to be the AA affiliate for the New York Yankees. They were replaced by the Somerset Patriots when the reorg happened, and now the Thunder are out in the cold. So that's what the MLB Draft League is. It's, I would say, one of the fifth or the sixth or the seventh best summer league, right? It's not that many elite top level players are going there. They're going to play for Team USA. They're going to play in the Cape Cod League. They're going to play in the Northwoods League. Those are the top three leagues easily, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of a lower level summer league.
Yeah.
That being said, they have a star attraction this year, and that is Rintaro Sasaki. Who is Rintaro Sasaki? Arguably one of the best hitters in the history of Japanese high school baseball, he made the shocking decision to forego playing in the NPB in the Japanese League and will be attending Stanford University. That's right, Stanford University in the fall. He was looking at a bunch of different big D1 programs, including Vanderbilt, ended up choosing to play in Palo Alto out in California. He will be there next season. He's insane. He's super good. He is a big, power-hitting, large lad.
Oh, yes.
He is a large lad. He will be old for a freshman. He's already 19 years old. I believe he will be draft-eligible as a sophomore.
Okay, so I've been trying to figure that out. Is that actually accurate? I've been trying to find his age, but if you've been asking and you've heard that he's 19, that is relevant, right? Because what we're talking about here, this is the reason why this is an important point to stick on before we get to what happened last night, is what you're about to say, the draft eligibility. Because if you are 21 by a certain age, if you're after your sophomore year, you are draft eligible. And if he is indeed already 19, there is a chance that he would be eligible for the 2026 draft as opposed to the 2027 draft.
All of the articles about him saying that he's 19. Okay. Two other interesting things about him. One, his father was the high school coach for both Yusei Kikuchi and Shohei Ohtani, right? So this dude has been around the ball, right? Yes. He's been around the ball. That's the first thing. And the second thing is this path is unprecedented. Top level Japanese players don't do this. There are some guys who have made the leap from high school baseball in Japan to play high level D1. One that comes to mind is the kid who was at Oregon a couple years ago, Riku Nishida.
So yeah,
he went JUCO, I believe, and then transferred to Oregon.
And now he's with the White Sox now. And having a good start to his pro career.
But this is different. This is a different thing. So he plays his first game last night for the Trenton Thunder, his first like in-game performance stateside. This is a dude to know and care about. And he homers in his very first game and his second at bat. And this was a hilarious moment because let's just say the camera quality and broadcast quality of the MLB Draft League leaves something to be desired.
Certainly in Frederick, Maryland, where it appears that they were using a, how shall I say this? I don't even know how to describe it. It's almost
flip
worse,
phone,
like security footage. It's like they were using, like they had like taped a webcam to the, like a cloudy webcam to the top of the center field wall.
That's the thing. It was so cloudy. It looked like someone was conducting a heist and the robber like sprayed something on the webcam to prevent people from spotting them.
Yeah. And it's hard because we know as well as anyone, right? Like these minor league affiliates, there's a reason Frederick ended up getting booted from affiliated baseball anyway, right? Like these are some of the considerations, which is stuff like this, which is the stuff around it. Because again, if we want to promote, we want to control, we want to have minor league baseball stuff that's happening in minor league ballparks shown around. There are still some affiliates in right now where you see the MLB TV feed is not good, right? That is still a problem, even at levels above this. However, in this specific case, this is not to bag on Frederick, but again, you have this unbelievable circumstance of one of the most famous amateur players we have in the country, in the world, making this game, and all the highlights going around are, you literally cannot see it. Now, fortunately, there were other people filming, what a surprise, thank goodness, to the point where even MLB Pipeline used other videos of the home run, but then they would tweet, "Tune in live here for his third at bat," whereas if you click that link, you're back to watching on a potato.
You can't see. And so here's my take. This is on MLB. No, like full stop. This is on MLB. This is on the league. Because if you are going to say that these places are affiliated with you, are affiliated with MLB, not with the team, but with the league, you need to ensure that when a moment like this comes up, you are doing everything possible to allow footage to be broadcast widely. Yes. That is the whole point. And what should have happened here is when Rintaro Sasaki announced, or it was announced that he was going to play in Frederick, MLB should have paid for two fancy cameras to the Frederick Stadium to be posted up there so that everyone could see it.
100%.
Frederick has no reason to, you know, buy a nice camera so that they can send this footage to the world for an opposing player. Not their fault at all. MLB missed out on this, and they are trying to grow these summer leagues, and I give them credit for that.
Yeah.
However, they will never have a better opportunity than literally this moment.
Yeah.
Rintaro Sasaki, I'm going to say it right now, is the best prospect who will play in this league for the next decade. And in his first game, in which he hit a star-tickling, skyscraping, cloud-touching ding-dong, we do not have legitimate footage of that. And that, I know for a lot of fans, no one cares about this, that is a big freaking swing and a miss for the league.
Yeah, yep, totally agree. I don't want to say too hard about what the next decade of this league is going to look like, but that gets to my final point about this, which is that if you want to take over a league of just six teams that were formerly affiliated and you want to make it an attractive place to play, part of the appeal to get players to come play in this league instead of the Cape and instead of the Northwoods is because, oh, in theory, if MLB's involved – Now we have, not only do you have all the TrackMan data, these are at you know, professional parks. It is the travel is much more contained. In theory, we should be promoting it with better streams and broadcasts.
It's more show.
It should be more show. It's more visibility because, listen, the Cape Cod League has all the rep because it's been there for years. They're playing on basically public park fields, which is there's charm to that too, which is amazing. But it's not like they have, you know, high-end video, whereas we've seen other leagues like the Northwoods League. You can watch it on ESPN Plus. Like, there are leagues that know how to promote it and get to that level. If you want this to be a place that players want to play, this cannot happen. Now, I know that Rintaro Sasaki is not there to get attention. He's there because he misses playing baseball, and he is looking for an opportunity to go challenge himself. And I'm sure that is what prompted this, because he has been practicing with Stanford over the last few months, but he's of course not been able to get any game action. So this is a great opportunity for him to start facing some college level competition. But so that's not why he's there. But there are a lot of players that do care about that. And if you want to get better players than Rintaro Sasaki in the future, this cannot happen. And so it is really that simple. All that said, I am excited to follow this. I am glad that he will be playing in parks with TrackMan so that I can tune in every night and say, oh, Rintaro Sasaki hit a ball 110 tonight. That's freaking awesome. And obviously, as college baseball fans, we are so excited to see him play for Stanford in whatever the hell conference they are playing in. In 2025. So anyway, that is that. Jake, we have one final topic before we say goodbye. And that is that we got a bit of news. We got a trade this morning. And that was Kevin Biggio, who was designated for assignment by the Toronto Blue Jays after a very strange tenure in Toronto. This is someone who at the beginning of his career was put up there right next to Vlad and Bo. And sure, he wasn't, you know, a top 10 prospect, but he was someone that was thought to be a core player. However, Jake,
time out. Yeah. His name was Kevin Mintz or Kevin Schusterman, mm-hmm. and not Kevin Biggio. Well, it would have been different.
It would be a big deal for us, though.
It would be a big deal for our families.
We would have talked about him a lot. Yes. But yeah, continue. Yeah.
Or if it was Vladimir Schusterman and Bo Mintz, right? It would also have been different.
Sure.
But it's just that the Blue Jays had three prospects coming up at the same time whose dads were legit very good to Hall of Fame level big leaguers. Yes. And so Biggio was kind of looped in with Bo and Vlad, which I think did a little bit of a disservice to him, because from a talent basis, he was never at that level.
No, definitely not. However, when he hits 26 home runs in Double A, and when he comes up as a rookie in 2019, and it seems like we might have had a little bit of benefit from whatever golf balls they were using that season. He does hit 16 home runs that year. He finishes fifth in the AL Rookie of the Year. But Kevin Biggio's skill, and honestly, he's still done this, is he does not swing at bad pitches. That is something that he has been good at for his whole career. However, what we have found out in the 5 years since his rookie season, where it looked like he was going to be, you know, a cornerstone piece for them, he doesn't really do anything else well. His defense is unspectacular, to the point where he has clearly been limited to second and third base, you know, some corner outfield. He clearly does not have significant plus power. He does strike out a lot to go along with his you know, stellar walk rates. And there's just not a lot of meat on the bone. And this is a large enough sample where it seems like the Blue Jays, who, you know, are always at this point clearly desperate to shake things up or at least try something different, they said, all right, that's it. You've kind of reached the end of the line here, Kevin Biggio. He is DFA'd and traded now this morning to the Dodgers of Los Angeles. Oh, boy.
Have the Dodgers announced, has there been any reporting about who's going to be booted from the roster?
Booted from the roster, no. It does appear like they will be getting a minor league pitcher back named Braden Fisher. So it's not necessarily a massive trade. However, it seems like they have an open 40-man spot, but yes, they will need to clear space on the active roster. So, I mean, looking at it again, right, the Dodgers what do we think?
It's probably Miguel Vargas. He's been good in limited time, but he's probably the one. He has an option, right? They would have to, you know, do something funky with Chris Taylor, Miguel Rojas. Yeah. They could option Gavin Lux. He's got two options. They could option Andy Pajes, but I think they'll keep Lux around because they want the left-handed bat. I think it'll probably be Vargas.
I think you're right. It is an interesting move considering what this does tell me is maybe Max Muncy's not coming back super fast. That's the first thing I think of, because you, when you look at the issues that Gavin Lux has had, okay, that's left-handed. I mean, I don't think they're replacing Gavin Lux. That seems extreme. But a lefty bat doesn't necessarily seem like what they need unless Muncy is still going to be out for a while, which it seems like is maybe the case. So it is an interesting little move. Can they tap into something more that Biggio has still been able to do? We will find out. But yeah, obviously whenever the Dodgers trade for anybody, we just kind of assume they will be rejuvenated there. And I know Blue Jays fans will, not that they're rooting against him, but you know, they aren't necessarily going to want to see that.
I mean, you have Kike Hernandez and Chris Taylor, who are these multi-positional guys that have struggled a lot. Biggio fits a similar role, but probably has a little bit more left in the tank that the Dodgers can squeeze out of it.
You are flying to Omaha today. The College World Series starts in a couple of days. And while we'll talk about a little bit more in depth on Friday, I think it is a good time to kind of set the stage for this as you head to Omaha. I will not be joining you this year, unfortunately. However, I am very excited, as always, for these eight teams to compete for a national championship. What are you most looking forward to this week, or for your few days you'll be in Omaha?
Yeah, we'll go more in depth into the College World Series on Friday. But the main thing to know is that there are four teams from the ACC and four teams from the SEC. It is the first time that has happened, the College World Series having only two conferences, since 1948. And in 1948, there were only two teams. Okay? There were only two teams. So the ACC and the SEC dominating the sport to this extent is reflective of what we've seen with the top heaviness of college sports over the last 10 years. I don't love it, if we're being honest. I would love to see a little bit more geographic diversity. Having more teams from different conferences, I think, provides a better flavor for Omaha. That being said, we have eight very exciting, very interesting teams: University of North Carolina, University of Virginia, Tennessee, Florida State, Kentucky, NC State, Texas A&M, and Florida.
Yeah, so the players to know, it is interesting because a lot of the guys who are projected to go in the top 10 ended up losing earlier in the postseason. However, Jack Caglione will be in the building. And it's kind of funny that he's the one that ends up there as this two-way sensation with ridiculous raw power, throws nearly 100 miles an hour from the left side, because Florida was barely over 500 in the regular season, and they kind of stormed through the postseason. They beat Clemson, and now they are back in Omaha, where they have become very familiar over the last couple decades. Unfortunately, Braden Montgomery, the top player in Texas A&M, who will also still likely be a top 10 pick, he broke his ankle during Super Regional, so he will not be playing. But Tennessee has just a litany of draft picks. I mean, they have five offensive players who could be going in the top 100 picks, plus right-handed pitcher Drew Beam. And then Florida State has a couple first-rounders, James Tibbs and Cam Smith. So there's still a good amount of star power in this Omaha field. But I will say what I am most excited are for teams like Kentucky. And while if you're maybe a casual college sports fan, you might think, oh, what's the big deal about Kentucky, you know, being in the Men's College World Series? Well, it's their first time. And I know they've had a lot of success in other collegiate sports, but Kentucky has kind of rapidly built themselves into a very interesting kind of powerhouse atop the SEC in these last couple of years. And while they are the number two overall seed, they are the team that I think is most likely to have the casual fan kind of embrace, because it's their first time there and because they are goofy. They are very, very goofy. I know a lot of college baseball teams like to get weird, but I think Kentucky is the team that I'm watching closest over these next couple weeks in Omaha.
All right, Jordan, enough from us. As you can hear, my voice is very yes. much at its
no limit. No mas. You got to go on the plane and don't say a word until you get to Omaha, Nebraska. Thank you to Andrew Hartz for producing. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com, and we'll be back on Friday. Hopefully Jake's voice is even better by then. Thank you all for listening. We'll talk to you soon.